Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Paul, Governor Sean Parnell has decided it's time to redirect the Alaska Gas Line. The governor doesn't want to go down through Canada to the Midwest anymore. We're going to Tidewater and we're going to the Orient. At least that's what he said in his speech here in Anchorage this week.
I think he, like a lot of people, including Larry Persily, head of the pipeline federal office for Alaska, believes that the big, large diameter line from the North Slope to Canada is, I think as Persily put it, high-centered. It's not going anywhere. It doesn't seem to be making any progress. The legislature is frustrated, very frustrated with the lack of progress. So what Parnell told an industry group was that he wanted to see BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon working together using AGIA, Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, to drive a line south to Valdez where it can be liquefied and put on vessels and sent somewhere. I'm not sure where. Somewhere in Asia.
Well, let me ask you this. Parnell is, by reputation and by what he said many, many times, a man who believes vigorously in a vigorous private sector. Why doesn't he leave it to them?
If we'll think back a few years, the private sector looked at this very route and said, well, no thanks, we're going to go to Canada. And this was back when oil prices were a little higher than they are now. Maybe something has changed. I don't know. This is going to be a question, I think, and I think, as you put it, it's going to be a question that's going to have to be settled by private industry,
unless the state
wants to buy in.
The governor says we'll go ahead and we'll get busy on this, and then we'll work out the tax regimen later. And the industry's position all along has been, no, we need to know that first.
That's always been one of the big sticking points. They want to know what is the financial framework in all of this. And
right.
It's one of the things that TransCanada has been complaining about, too, in terms of trying to find buyers for gas and things like that. They want to know what the terms are. So, you know, that's something I think that they're going to have to reassess. The only thing I can think about is the speech is that Bill Walker wrote it. He had to write the speech, right?
Or Sean that's very good. That's excellent.
Channeling Bill Walker, because this is what Bill, and just to refresh everybody's memory, Bill Walker ran for governor. And a lot of people criticized him as saying, oh, he's a one-issue candidate, and that was a gas line to Tidewater and ship it over to Asia, where they need the energy and siphon off a good amount too for Alaska markets as well, provide cheap energy here. So all of a sudden this has come around here, and so Mr. Walker's got to be really, you know, pretty happy to hear this, because he truly is. I feel, well, this is certainly, I think he's an expert on this particular subject, and this is what he's been advocating all the time.
One of the things, I talked to somebody who's very familiar with this project who explained to me or reminded me that if the builders and shippers went to Tidewater, they would lose both the tax credits that Congress has proposed and the overrun cost guarantees.
Yeah.
So this would be as much of as a billion-dollar loss potentially to the builders, if they went to the Tidewater route.
Yeah, you know, I've heard so many things too, Michael, over the last few years about this thing too. I can remember a remark in one of the media outlets, maybe it was the Daily News, where TransCanada said, well, you know, they decide they want to go to Valdez, we build pipelines there too, you know, so we can do that.
The spokesman, Tony Palmer of TransCanada, did invite bids. And they didn't get much action.
No, and the other thing is there's always been this speculation with folks involved in this that eventually Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and BP would join forces with TransCanada. You would have to have the big three up there get involved with TransCanada. And there were folks who said, you know, it's going to take some time, but they'll eventually get there and they'll all be unified in this particular project.
TransCanada was saying that 4 or 5
right.
years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah. I mean, but Paul, Exxon is in with them at the present time.
Exactly,
right?
But it's still going to take the other two.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that could happen.
Let's stick with Paul. Mayor Dan Sullivan will ask the legislature for $350 million, Paul, to complete the Anchorage Port project. Refresh us. What is this all about?
Last year, Governor Sheffield asked for $320 million to finish the project. I think he got 30. So, yeah. He's rolling a stone uphill in this one. What the $350 million will do will be allow the city to finish a much smaller port than they started out to build and suit the city's needs, the state's needs for 40 or 50 years, they say. They're asking the state to either make a direct appropriation, the legislature, or come up with a bond. What has happened is this thing, they had all kinds of construction problems, design problems, project management difficulties, a lot of questions about how the whole thing came together. And at this point in time, we've lost Ted Stevens in the Senate, so all the federal money now is hard to come by. $350 million, Sullivan says, will allow them to finish up, I think it's the north end of the port, mm-hmm. and just kind of go with a smaller, more compact unit for some years.
Steve, how is the legislature apt to respond to this request?
Well, I think favorably. I do think favorably. I think Mayor Sullivan's gotten a lot of kudos from the Assembly, from legislators who have been watching this project as well. He's kind of circled wagons on this a little bit. He looked at this project. It was way over budget. A lot of things have gone wrong on this particular project. And it was sort of like a money pit. Is everybody going to be pouring money into it? He prioritized what needs to be done to make this a viable, growing port into the future. And tried to keep a lid on the costs. Came up with $350 million. That'll do the trick, he says. So a lot of and plus there wasn't a lot of oversight, it seemed like, on this particular project as well. So he's worked it out with the builders and others to have more oversight over the project. So I think that satisfied a lot of the people who were involved in this thing and who were very concerned about just how much money this thing was sucking up. So he's now, I think, that folks realize what an important piece of infrastructure that the port of Anchorage is. Almost everything that we, you know, the old adage is that we eat, wear, or drive comes through that port, and that's for the entire state. So I think the legislature will go for this and see that it's money well spent, and it's not pouring bad money after, or good money after bad.
Let's continue with what Steve just said, Paul. The Sullivan administration, others in Anchorage, have argued this is a statewide project benefiting the statewide, it's not an appropriation for Anchorage. Have they had much success selling that argument?
I don't know what happened last year, why they came away from the legislature with so little money. I'm not well versed in that. Sullivan has spent a lot of time over the past year gathering federal officials together and state officials, mm-hmm. city officials, port officials, and I think they've all worked out most of the problems. I think they're back on track. They know who's in charge. They know there's oversight. I think he'll have not all that much problem selling the fact that this is a state project. That came up the last time they were arguing about this. What the main driving force trying to block this project or throw this project off track. In 2005, this was a $360 million project, and now it's a billion-dollar project. Yeah. And people are very nervous about that. And I think
it'd be legitimate for them to say, Mr. Mayor, if we give you this money, explain to us how you're going to guarantee this as you can finish it.
Well, I think they've got their ducks. It sounds to me like they've got their ducks mm-hmm. in a row at this point.
And that's probably the question he's going to be asked by the Anchorage caucus, the Assembly, by the full legislature when this comes up for a vote this upcoming session.
Which he has to explain to them on November 18th.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve, let's stick with you. Governor Sean Parnell says he won't ask the legislature to restore the Coastal Zone Management Program, and a group of Alaskans who want that program say, well, okay, Governor, we're going to circulate an initiative petition and we're going to put it on the ballot.
Yep. This was something that was before the legislature during the last session, and everything was so calm and peaceful the way the last legislative session ended. No, it wasn't. I'm obviously sarcastic there. This thing kind of like fell through the cracks. People try to resurrect it. This gives coastal areas, coastal towns, villages, a say in development that would go along their coastline, offshore drilling, coal mines, whatever that's going to go in there. It gives these communities a say in what's going to happen. some folks say, well, there's enough oversight in some of these projects. We really, really don't need any more. It's another flaming hoop we have to jump through. So, you know, this thing died a very unpeaceful death last legislative session. So some folks want this back in there. And the governor says, well, I'm not going to introduce the legislation. Now, somebody else could. And the legislature could go back and approve it, but if that doesn't happen, they're going to they're focusing.
Well, and they got into a huge argument about what the bill would contain and how it'd be worded and so forth. Paul, how did this program, the Coastal Zone Management Program, that existed for many years, become so contentious?
I think people started taking it seriously. they started actually using it, and a debate erupted over local control, local say versus. Local knowledge versus scientific evidence.
And the continued federal role.
The continued federal role. Yeah. It's an opt-in program. You don't have to opt into it if you don't want to.
Yeah.
But when they did, and this thing is wide-ranging enough where offshore oil and gas development, that's a red flag to anybody in the administration to have small communities up and down the coast able to block that. I can only imagine that the Parnell administration would be pretty. That thing last time not only didn't make it to the legislature, didn't it fail in two special sessions?
Oh, yeah. One after the other. Oh, you can't make legislation under those circumstances. No. We said that back then. You just can't do that.
I think people started to take it seriously, and maybe people got afraid.
You know, it's funny. There's a little irony here, I think. Anyways, we tell Washington, D.C. all the time to butt out. We know what's going on in Alaska. We live here. We know the terrain. You don't have a say. You're 15 million miles away or whatever it is. Now these communities are kind of saying the same thing. We live along this coastline. This is our neighborhood state. You know, we know what's going on.
Well, of course, they say we're not here to block development. What we're here to do is offer our views and participate in the decision. The other side doesn't see it that way. Yeah. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins and Steve McDonald. Paul, an update on Pebble. With all the votes counted in the election in Southwest Alaska, the group that is opposing Pebble had a small majority of the votes, and the groups that's advocating Pebble now says, well, we're not going to go to court on this matter to challenge the election. We're not going to challenge the election further, but we are going to go to court in general on the question of what's in the legislation.
They're already in court. They've been in court since prior to the vote. Pebble Partnership and the state of Alaska, the Attorney General's office, they decided not to contest the vote count, saying that the officials there did a good job. But they're going to pursue. They continue the lawsuit at a hearing here in a couple of weeks before a Superior Court judge. What they're contending is that the election, why they tried to stop the election. They contend the election is unconstitutional, that local communities in the state of Alaska don't have control of the state's resources, that constitutionally falls to the state government. And I think then that's why they're going into court. I know that Pebble's going. I am assuming the state is going back and pursuing that. It's very much a state issue.
Okay. Steve, Governor Parnell is taking big-time heat on another front, the proposed Chwitna coal mine on the west side of Cook Inlet. Please outline the controversy for us and give us a little sense of what's at stake here, because I was quite surprised. This is new, or at least new at the level of a major controversy.
I think it underscored how controversial this is when we opened up the newspaper a couple of days ago, and there's this full-page ad calling the governor a liar. So it was they've stepped up the debate on this quite a bit, the folks who are opposed to this coal mine. But it's I think it's Pac Rim is the company that wants to develop a large coal mine on the west side of Cook Inlet, near Tyonek, near Beluga. They want to ship this coal to China, which uses that coal to power its energy infrastructure. The big bone of contention here is there's a creek, Middle Creek, and 11 miles of this creek, which is prime salmon habitat, would be taken out of commission. It would be wiped out. Now, this coal mine is supposed to last for 25 years. Pac Rim says at the end of this coal mine's life cycle, after 25 years, we will restore this creek to pristine conditions. The state says, okay, well, we think you can do that, so go ahead and do this. And it denied a petition from the folks who are against the coal mine that says that this land is unsuitable for this type of development. So they're very upset about
this. Steve, do we know anything about the people who are leading the opposition to the mine?
There are folks, you've got Cook Inlet Keeper.
Right.
They're part of it, but then you also have residents who live there in Tyonek and Beluga and who depend on salmon for subsistence and for commercial fishing.
And I think it's fair
too.
To say that Cook Inlet Keeper is, in effect,
an environment.
Environmental, but it's a represents fishermen
right.
specifically.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Were you surprised to see the full page ad in the paper calling the governor a liar?
Yeah, I was. That really it caught our attention. We were in our morning news meeting, kind of thumbing through it, and this jumped out. It really that's a pretty dramatic step.
It isn't exactly the first step to let's talk this over and see if we can work this out.
No, it went right to the edge, right there.
Okay.
So yeah, you have to wonder, well, how is that going to affect any negotiations or any talks in the future?
It sounds like C in court is what we're talking about.
It sounds like it.
Okay, Paul, is this another project that will endure as a matter of controversy for years or perhaps decades? Do we have any timeline here that can tell us how long it might be before we can see some kind of development or a decision?
I think we have a decision.
but
like everything else in the state of Alaska, it's going to be settled in court. There's going to be years and years of this. I don't know that we can have a huge development in the state of Alaska that encroaches on a salmon stream or on wildlife habitat or wetlands or anything else and not wind up in court years and years after a very bitter fight, which starts off, I mean, where can we go from here? We're calling the governor a liar on day one right out of the chute. So I guess, it's technologically feasible to rebuild that salmon stream after 25 years, but I don't think Cook Inlet Keeper, I don't think anybody who lives over there is going to tolerate it, and it's going to wind up being in court off and on probably the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Steve McDonald, you recently took a trip.
Yeah.
To the gas fields of North Dakota. You were
representing
Great vacation, Channel 2.
By the way, you guys.
And went out to western North Dakota and saw the drilling that's taking place, the so-called fracking.
Yes.
And learned quite a bit.
It was pretty informative. The reason why we went down there was we kept hearing about how there's a number of Alaska companies, probably about a half dozen right now, but I would say at least 100 Alaskans who worked up on the North Slope. They're working down in North Dakota. There's a migration. Some call it a brain drain of Alaskan workers going down to North Dakota to work in the Bakken oil field. And if you're not familiar with that field, just take the western third of North Dakota, and that's pretty much the Bakken. It's 15,000 square miles.
It extends, if I might interrupt you just briefly, into Montana as well.
It extends into Montana, extends up into Alberta. Yep, up into Canada, province of Alberta. So it's wide ranging, and they say, well, it's the size of West Virginia. We always have to pick on one of those eastern states to compare size, but it's a massive field. And there were so we went down and we did the story about all these Alaskans who are heading down there to work, and they're just saying, well, the North Slope is slowed down so much in production, there's not a lot of work up there. So a lot of these companies are saying, I've got millions, like Cruise Construction out of Wasilla, so I've got multi-million dollars worth of investment in cranes and trucks. I've got to do something with them, and I've got all these guys. So we've just reversed everything. Instead of sending up workers up onto the North Slope for 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off, they're shipping them down to North Dakota to work these kinds of shifts. Other companies have followed Cruz's lead. There's a company called Black Gold out of Fairbanks. Jim and Chris Huffman, father and son team, they own it. They've set a man camp up, 900 beds in Williston, and they're expanding this thing. So they and Williston is sort of the epicenter of this whole field.
And if can you go out into, if you're driving around, are you going to see drill rigs?
Yep, you do. There's drill rigs all over the place. You just go, I've never spent that much time in North Dakota driving around. I'd been to Grand Forks to do a hockey game years ago with UAA in North Dakota. And so going to the west, it's flat prairie, and you see a lot of these rigs that have popped up. There's like 200 working Bakken right now. And at night is when you get the best perspective because you've got lights that are on the rigs, and then you've got the flare pads on the wells that have already been developed. So you can really see off into the distance the lighted up rigs and then the flames from the flares. So you get a real good idea just how much activity is going on down there.
And not only is some of the activity controversial, but according to the New Yorker magazine piece we both read, the leasing, the fees that are charged for privilege of leasing land and drilling are, I mean, it's a lot of money that some of these farmers are getting.
Some of them are instant millionaires, or maybe not instant, but they're on their way to being
millionaires. And hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a couple things there. What it sparked a bit more of a debate, or added fuel to the debate up here, about whether or not HB 110 in the Alaska legislature right now, should cut our taxes on oil, on the oil industry here in Alaska, to spur more production up on the North Slope. There are two major developments that took place to get this field down in North Dakota going. One was the fracking, the new technology,
right,
fracking and directional drilling. They give tax breaks to any company who goes down and does that technique. And the other was they lower their tax rates. And so now Alaskans are saying, well, we should be doing the same
thing. And of course, everything there is accessible by road, or not everything, but
just about,
most,
though, you're right. And, yeah, yeah.
Which, you don't have to go to the North Slope or even drive the Alaska Highway.
No.
Steve, I wanted to ask you one other thing about the mobility of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we're, I don't know if deploring it is, but we're not happy about it. Alaskans going down there to work.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of our people who came here from someplace else. It's sort of the pattern of the industry is mobility,
right? It really
right?
is. That's right. And yeah, we're always complaining about Oklahomans or Texans coming up. These jobs should be going to Alaskans. It's happening where you've got folks from Wyoming, you've got folks from Oklahoma, Texas, and Alaska, a good number of Alaskans who are going down into North Dakota. But they don't have enough people for the jobs down there. In fact, it's, you know, one of the pieces that we did, our shameless plug, our series starts Monday, it goes Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. On Wednesdays...
Don't miss it.
we interviewed a woman who owns the Dairy Queen in Williston, and she can't keep people. She's got to close the Dairy Queen down like at 5 o'clock in the evening, and she's closed the kitchen down already, and she's, because she can't keep people. People going out, she had a kid that worked for her for 2 days, went out in the parking lot, guy says, hey kid, I need help in the oil field, you want it? So he turns around and says, I'm
Steve,
gone.
I believe I'm correct, North Dakota has the lowest unemployment
3%
in the United States.
1% in Williston, which again is like the center of all of this activity.
Which is effectively zero.
Right.
Paul, anything you want to add after hearing the wisdom of Steve? Or
I wish we had all our legislators would watch the series. I think that would be a very good thing.
Thank
for
you for the shameless plug.
Yeah.
I would add here that I was recently in New York State. I went through Scranton and Binghamton and up to Ithaca, where I went to college many years ago. And fracking is a controversy in southern New York State and in northern Pennsylvania. Farmers there who have much smaller farms out in North Dakota are being offered $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for the opportunity to drill in their drill rigs. And one of my college classmates owns a camp in Ithaca, New York, or Trumansburg, where many of these people come and stay, so there is something of a mini boom going on, even as far as, I guess you could say, north as central New York State.
Right. And the fracking thing, too, is like 95%, they directionally drill. It's like an Oreo cookie. That's the best way you could describe it. You've got two layers of shale that contain the oil, and then there's a dolomite in between, and it's concrete. So you go in, directionally drill, blow holes in the concrete, and the oil sifts down, and then they can drill it out.
As my understanding is, the controversy is mostly about the wastes when they're done, right?
That and the chemical. There's like 5% of this mixture. 95% is supposedly water and 5% chemicals, and that goes down into the... So they worry about that 5% too, and the waste.
Okay. Steve, I'm going to stick with you.
Okay, yeah.
Reapportionment. We've had some developments recently. The plaintiffs, mostly Petersburg and Fairbanks, have backed off quite a bit. What do we hear?
Petersburg has pulled out, or wants to pull out of a lawsuit, and has petitioned a judge to do so. The North Star Borough up in Fairbanks wants to do the same. And it's basically, the reasons is finances. It's very expensive for these communities to press this kind of legislation that, again, as Paul so well pointed out earlier, you'll probably go to the Supreme Court. Everything major gets settled in court here. So both of these communities want to pull out because of finances, but they also want to have a say. So I think they basically have filed to be friends of the court to challenge the way these districts were redistricted after the last census. They feel that some of the districts aren't compact enough, aren't a fair representation of the folks.
In Fairbanks' case, part of their Suburbs are mixed in with a district that runs all the way to the coast of Alaska.
Right. I mean, yeah, what do you have in common with the folks there? You know, and what do the folks there have in common with people in Fairbanks? It's a tough place. I mean, you have a lot of land and very few people in between. Alaska is always unique in that way.
Paul, you want to add something here on the reapportionment controversy?
Well, the redistricting board's main job was not dilute the native vote. Mm-hmm. And I think some of these districts, although they look strange, I think that they've maintained the native vote, and which is the Justice Department's pretty much happy with the way they came up with this. So.
And they had to come up with districts that are roughly about the same about size. I think it's about 17 or 18,000.
Something like that.
They have
that.
A variance that they have to stick with.
And Petersburg, I think, has dropped all of its mm-hmm. complaints, except for compactness.
Right.
They're pursuing the compactness issue, I think, just to stay in the game, stay in the fight.
And when you see the map of Alaska with all of its odd shapes and
it's like that
directions.
In every state, though.
Yeah.
Every state's got, if you look at the district,
well, in Nebraska, the Lincoln suburbs are in with western Nebraska, which is the Colorado border. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you next week. Please come back to Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.